It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this half hour is Thomas Frank. Thomas Frank is a cultural and political columnist for Salon, also the founding editor of The Baffler magazine, the author of the books What's the Matter with Kansas?, Pity the Billionaire, and One Market Under God. Tomorrow, Wednesday, February 4th at 7 p.m., he'll be speaking at Shambaugh Auditorium at the University of Iowa Main Library. The title of his topic, What's the Matter with Liberals? Thomas Frank, welcome to our program.
And how are you today, Ben?
I am doing fine. In your book, What's the Matter with Kansas?, you wrote about how Republicans have transformed themselves in the past several decades and how, as the subtitle to the book states, how conservatives won the heart of America. Tomorrow, you want to address the question, what's the matter with liberals? Give us a preview of that.
Well, I mean, one side wins and the other side loses. And what intrigues me is that liberals lose even as, the sort of objective circumstances seem to be going their way. I mean, from the 80s up till the present, the country is becoming more and more unequal. You know, we hear about inequality all the time now. There's nobody, it's like global warming. Almost nobody denies it, that it's happening, you know, that it's been going on. And someone like me observing this wonders why it is that we can't start moving the country back in the why the Democrats can't start moving the country back in the opposite direction, why they not only can't muster the force to do that, but they can't even win can't even win a lot of elections. They do win the presidential contest, of course, but we just saw them lose again in the off-year elections just a few months ago.
Now, it's what you're talking about is summed up nicely in a recent headline to one of your columns, which states, "It's not just Fox News, how liberal apologists torpedoed change, helped make the Democrats safe for Wall Street." Talk about these apologists and what you mean by them.
Well, one of the phenomena that I've been really interested in for the last few years is Obama disillusionment. This is, what I'm referring to are people who sort of got swept up in the mania for Barack Obama in 2008. This is a very well-known phenomenon, and have been really disappointed with his presidency ever since. Or not ever since, but, since then have become disappointed, I should say. And that phenomenon is intriguing to me for a number of reasons, among them that, I myself am disappointed with what Barack Obama has done. I had high hopes for his presidency back in 2008. And, I thought it was a sort of a historical turning point that year because of the financial crisis, the Wall Street meltdown, everything basically falling apart economically. I thought that the country was going to, had elected this this man who seemed like a, exactly what we needed for that period in time. And instead, he succeeded in getting Wall Street, bailed out, propped back up, and up and running again. He's had, a number of other successes in his presidency, but that is the sort of the main disappointment, that Wall Street managed to recover after this fantastic disaster, while the rest of the economy, we're only just coming out of recession, most people, average people, just coming out of the recession now. There was even a poll, I'm going to wander a little bit away from the subject here, but there was a poll just before the election, just before last November, where a large majority of the American public said they thought the recession was still going on. This is the recession that ended in 2009, mm-hmm. Technically speaking. And that's disappointing. That is objectively a disappointment. That is evidence of disappointment. So, I've tried to express this disappointment in all sorts of ways over the last couple of years. And what has been intriguing to me are the way that the defenders of President Obama go about defending him from this particular kind of critique, this critique from the sort of disappointed perspective. And it always, you know, it always sort of follows the same lines, which is basically and this is where the story gets really strange. People who defend the president do so on the grounds that the president is basically powerless. And you find this again and again and again in all sorts of pundit, sort of high-end pundit journalism, especially here in Washington, D.C., that the president is essentially powerless. There's no possible way he could have done the kind of things that, you know, his disillusioned former followers wanted him to do. And, you know, we just need to stop having such high expectations. It's impossible you know, get real.
But that's why he was elected, because people believed, his followers believed, that he could change Washington in a postpartisan way.
Yeah, the postpartisanship, that was always the that was in my view, that was always the mistake. That, I mean, when I look back over the Obama presidency, you know, that he had a number of different things in front of him. You know, the main issue at the time was obviously the economy. You know, and the sort of catastrophic events on Wall Street. But Obama convinced himself that the more important issue was partisanship, that what he was really sent to Washington to solve was not, you know, this sort of terrible economic problem, but this other problem, this problem that, you know, the two parties fight with each other like cats and dogs, which of course they do. And he focused on that problem instead, and I think this was a sort of basic strategic blunder on his part. Now you can blame me for this. I you can probably blame a lot of his other followers too. When he used to talk about postpartisanship when he was running for president, I didn't take it very seriously, because everybody running for president says that sort of thing.
Exactly.
You know? It's just a cliche. It's, you know, every politician talks that way.
I wonder if you think, Thomas Frank, that wonder or can point to any ways in which President Obama has changed the politics of Washington, or is it the same or worse in terms of partisan politics as when he came in?
Oh, I think it's probably a little bit worse, but he has. Let's not. I don't want to brush off his accomplishments. As you know, he has done some pretty amazing things. He got his health reform plan passed in some form. You know, it didn't get through the way that he originally wanted it to, and I don't think it really solves the problem, but it's a start. And he got that done. He got an enormous stimulus bill passed. That was kind of amazing. But in terms of partisanship, I mean, this is a problem that I don't know if it can be solved, because it would require, you know, it's a sort of a game that they play here in Washington, D.C. And when I say they, I specifically mean both sides play it, of course, obviously. But in the Republican Party, there's a much more developed sense of, obstructionism is kind of a, you know, a bona fide strategy there. This goes back to the days of Newt Gingrich, who, you know, you recall back in the 1990s, sort of invented this as a way of dealing with the Democrats, and was very successful as a majority leader, was able to, you know, to get Republicans in control of the House of Representatives for the first time since the Great Depression. And so this was a very successful strategy for him, except for it also, you know, backfired in certain ways. You know, you had the government shutdowns back then. But what's interesting is that that strategy has this, it has a very real fan base. You know, you mentioned earlier Barack Obama planning or promising to get to the end of partisanship and get beyond partisanship. Democrats are always taken by that kind of myth of post-partisanship. They always go for that.
But at least in his first couple of years, Obama, at least outwardly, and I can't know, of course, what took place behind the scenes, outwardly played nice, acted as if this post-partisan era had a chance.
I mean, it depends on who you ask, of course. So one of the things that makes this issue so fun is that everybody perceives it differently. You know, you can look at the same thing, and everybody has a different view on it. But the moment that I knew it was all over was when I heard this term that he liked to use, the grand bargain. You remember this? He doesn't talk about it anymore, but he did in those days. And the idea was that Democrats and Republicans would come together, and it would be like, you know, signing this sort of grand treaty that, you know, like the Armistice of K Street or something like that. And they would sort of divide up the issues, and Democrats would get they would get to restore, you know, the higher taxes for the rich or something like that, and Republicans would get to finally reform Social Security in some way, and so both sides would get something, and they would you know, have this grand budget deal, and it would solve partisan squabbling. He really tried hard to get Republicans to sign on, and it wasn't just the sort of grand bargain budget deal. It was also in, take for example the health care reform, the big mm-hmm. Obamacare reform. He desperately wanted Republicans to sign on to that.
If you've just joined us, my guest this half hour is Thomas Frank. Thomas Frank, a cultural and political columnist for Salon. A moment ago, Thomas, you talked about income equality being recognized by all on the political spectrum as existing. I want you to talk about, and you've written about this, how this income gap, this widening gap, is being spun by each side of the political spectrum.
The funny thing is that there's a lot of agreement between people from both parties that it's all due to education. That the widening inequality is all a product of different, that some people go to college and other people don't, and people who go to college are winning these great prizes, and people who don't are getting nothing, and that's the source of it all. Other people say, it's inevitable. There's absolutely nothing that can be done about it, and then you have. There's all sorts of different theories about it. One of the most interesting ones is that there's a libertarian economist whose name I'm blanking on at the moment, who thinks that we're just beginning, entering into this new world of inequality, and because of all the changes in technology and globalization, it's just going to get worse and worse and worse. And the funny thing is, he thinks that's just fine.
If you're on top, it's fine.
Adjustments around the edges, but that's as it should be, because the people who are winning deserve to win.
Right. It's always been about, from one perspective, it's always been about not that there's a gap. We know there's a gap. That's the part of the American way. But that we want to ensure there is mobility, that the humblest person, the humble means person, can ascend the ladder. Right.
Yeah, equality of opportunity, they say, and that's that's very important. That's part of the American tradition, and that's why we have public education in this country. Everybody gets to have some kind of fair shot at success in this country. That's itself kind of a thorny issue, and that, by the way, that's what President Obama has said in his famous speech on the subject last year, was that what we really are concerned about doing is equality of opportunity, not equality of outcomes, which of course would be impossible. The trouble is, equality of opportunity itself requires all kinds of spending, government policies, I mentioned public schools, but do you ever think about the state of the university system in this country and how it's become so expensive to go to college mm-hmm. in America? The tuition is completely out of control. And one of the reasons for that is because so many states don't want to pay for their state university anymore. And so that, the tuition is completely out of control. And lots of people can't afford, to go to college, which is something that everybody acknowledges they need to do nowadays. So, yeah, there's basically, that's the that's where everybody argues back and forth about the issue. I actually think that it's bigger than that, and there are all sorts of things that you could do to achieve greater equality that you need to do. I mean, I think that it goes far beyond inequality of opportunity. You want me to tell you what I think we should do?
Yes.
Well, I mean, there are some really obvious things. One of them is antitrust. I mean, all of these policies that started about the same time as inequality took off, you know, deregulation, that kind of thing. But one of the biggest ones was that we stopped enforcing antitrust laws in this country. And those of your listeners who are farmers are going to know immediately what I'm talking about. We stopped enforcing antitrust laws in the early 1980s, with the result that now, you know, these enormous companies have achieved oligopolies just all across the economy, and especially in having to do with you know, buying farm products. Another thing that you could do that would deal with inequality in a huge way would be to bring back organized labor. I mean, as you know, it's extremely difficult to organize a union in a workplace nowadays.
So what you're reminding me of is 100 years ago, and the
that's exactly right. I talk about this all the time too. It's like an episode of the Twilight Zone or something. We are relearning everything that our grandparents our grandparents had to learn back around the year 1900 or so. We have to figure it all over again.
Where is the
for ourselves?
Right. Where is the trust buster? I'm going to suggest.
I thought it was Obama.
Well, instead of Theodore Roosevelt, what do you think of Elizabeth Warren?
Well, that would be really awesome. I'm a big fan of Elizabeth Warren's. I did an interview with her on Salon that I thought was really fascinating. You know, her heart is in the right place, and she understands a lot of these financial issues better than almost anyone else in politics. Unfortunately, she said she has no interest in running for president. But, you know, she has a lot of influence right there in the U.S. Senate. The funny thing is, if I could just take a step back here, when we're talking about Obama disappointment, how we started the show, when he was running for president in 2008, one of the ways that he won, you remember the Iowa caucus is extremely important in winning the nomination. He went around in Iowa and promised to bring back antitrust enforcement, you know, mm-hmm. and has done almost nothing on that front. And the funny thing is, he could do it tomorrow if he felt like. There's no larger force keeping him from doing it. It's entirely up to the president and the Department of Justice how they want to enforce the antitrust laws are on the books. You know, they're not right. going away. It's just up to the president if he wants to enforce them.
Okay, we've just got you for a couple more minutes, Thomas Frank, as we wind up this conversation with you. I can't let you go without talking more. We ventured into Elizabeth Warren territory, talking about 2016, but let's talk quickly about each field. The GOP, at this point, no obvious front runner, wide open field. Who or what do you have your eyes on there, quickly?
Well, I think Chris Christie is going to be the man to beat, if not George Bush's brother Jeb. But one of the most interesting, there's a couple of really interesting guys out there. Rick Santorum intrigues me because of his populist rhetoric last time around. You might recall that. Rand Paul is really interesting because he is trying so hard to extend the sort of Republican brand to groups that aren't traditionally Republicans. I mean, fascinating candidates this time around among the Republicans.
On the Democratic side, of course,
Hillary.
All Hillary. the question need not be asked, will she run? It's looking like she will run. She's acting like it, certainly. What will be her biggest challenges that her campaign faces?
I think that her biggest challenge is what she thinks is her biggest strength, which is her husband Bill Clinton. Because whenever you talk about these issues of inequality, antitrust, organized labor, all of the stuff that we've been talking about here, you have to go back and look at the presidency of her husband. Mm-hmm. Which a lot of people remember fondly because it was good times towards the end there. You know, we had this booming economy. Things were doing really well. But if you look at the actual policies that he pursued, you know, things like NAFTA, those are deeply unpopular. Bank deregulation, you know, these are things that Bill Clinton did. And Hillary will have to, I assume, will have to answer for them.
Will he play a bigger role in Iowa, in other places, than he did in the last campaign, the unsuccessful campaign against Barack Obama?
I think he will. I think Bill Clinton loves politics.
Oh, you think so?
yeah. I think you can't keep that man down, you know? I've been reading a bunch of different biographies of the guy. What a fascinating character he is. Yeah. And it's funny about all of these, I guess, is the nature of politicians. As much as I disagree with so many of the things that Bill Clinton did while he was president, I really like the guy. You know, he just seems like what a friendly person, what a great guy to meet. You know, and I'll tell you, I think the same thing about Barack Obama. I'm very critical of him in print, but at the end of the day, I really want him to succeed. I want him to be a great president, and it's disappointing to me that he hasn't lived up to his promise.
So picking up on that point, is it entirely clear what his legacy will be, what's possible for him in the 2 years that he has left in office?
I mean, his legacy is going to be what he did in his first 2 years. If he gets anything done in his last 2 years, it'll be another free trade deal and maybe his grand bargain compromise on the budget, you know, some kind of Social Security privatization measure. And those are not going to be popular. Neither one of those would be a popular thing. I think his legacy will always go back to the things he did in his first few years in office. And you have to remember something else about him. You know, he has had no catastrophic mistakes. There's no Monica Lewinsky here. There's no Iraq war. He hasn't done anything, no major blunders with this guy. I think what historians will say about the Obama years is that we came to a turning point in 2008. We came to a turning point and we didn't turn. And I think that's ultimately what we have to judge Barack Obama for. He no doubt thought it was, you know, very wise, very postpartisan to just prop everything up and get it going as usual. You know, no New Deal kind of situation here, no Franklin Roosevelt situation. But I think in retrospect, that will look more and more like a terrible mistake.
Thomas Frank, thank you for being with us this half hour. We look forward to welcoming you to Iowa tomorrow. You're speaking tomorrow, February 4th at 7 p.m. on the University of Iowa campus at the main library. Thomas Frank, cultural and political columnist for Salon. Thanks for spending the time with us.
Sure, absolutely. Anytime.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.